You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Spring is right around the corner, and with it, a plethora of outdoor activities. Whether you're into spring turkey hunting, fishing at the lake, or shed hunting and managing your deer property, our partners have got you covered. First up, Tacticam is our title sponsor, and their point-of-view cameras are my go-to method for filming my hunts. Their 6.0 camera has a built-in 1-inch LCD touchscreen that has totally changed the game for me. Its lightweight design, weatherproof housing, and one-touch operation really simplify the self-filming process and to make sure that I've got high-quality footage to share with my family and friends. My personal favorite setup for turkey season is a 6.0 camera mounted to my shotgun, one on a stake in my decoy spread if I'm using decoys, and one on a bendy clamp mount for an over-the-shoulder angle. And I pair these cameras with the Tacticam remote so I can turn on all three cameras with the push of a single button. To learn more or pick up your 6.0 today, head over to Tacticam.com. Share your hunt with Tacticam. Next up, no matter where my spring pursuits take me, I know I'll be hunting in comfort with my Huntworth camo. They make high-quality, technical hunting clothing at a fraction of the price of other brands. Last turkey season, I hunted in temps ranging from the teens to the mid-80s, snowstorms, pouring rain, blazing sun, and all of that was during the same 10-day trip, and my Huntworth gear had me covered for every single bit of it. My favorites for this time of year include the Durham lightweight pants, the Shelton hoodie, and of course, the Winstead rain suit lives in my Hickory pack at all times. You can grab your Huntworth gear at huntworthgear.com. Finally, the Onyx Hunt app is an absolutely indispensable tool for me this time of year. Whether I'm chasing longbeards, looking for an access point when fishing, or just taking the family on a hike, the Onyx Hunt app helps me find access to where I want to be. One of my favorite things to do with the Hunt app this time of year is to get out and roost birds prior to the season, marking them on the Hunt app, then triangulate their location from different listening points, so I've got a really good idea of where those turkeys are roosting once the season rolls around. To learn more about all the awesome features of the Onyx Hunt app, head over to their website, onyxmaps.com. Now let's get into this week's show.
What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast, which is brought to you by Tacticam. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things outdoors in the Badger State. Folks, I hope you're having a good week so far. As I record this, it is 4 p.m. just after on April 17th, Wednesday, opening day of turkey season. Now, by the time this comes out, if you follow us on Instagram at the Wisconsin Sportsman Pod, you know how my morning went. I wasn't alone, though. I had my girlfriend Sarah with me. She's actually with me right now as well. Sarah, how you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
Doing great. It'd be a lot better if we would have killed a bird this morning, but we're going to tell that story real quick as part of our intro before we dive into this, just because, you know, I'd like to hope that maybe some people listening to this whiffed on a bird as well. I don't know if they did it on opening day, but a lot can happen in the turkey woods. I figured at the very least we could tell the story of what went right and what went wrong so far on opening day of turkey season. So let's rewind a little bit here. Last night we had a freaking tornado watch, warning, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Blew like crazy. Tons of rain. Ended up getting off work early, so I ran out to this patch of public that I spent some time on last fall. Never spent any time out there chasing turkeys, though, although I knew they were out there. But I hiked out there last night and didn't hear a freaking thing. And as I'm sure you can attest, I was kind of panicking because we didn't...
Lost all hope.
Yeah, and there was...
Completely discouraged.
It was a tough morning, okay? It was to the point where when we were pulling in and I was like, well, I hope this hunt's more than just a stretch of the legs for us early this morning. But I had a backup plan there, but you were on me telling me that... I can't talk that negatively going into a hunt or else neither of us are going to want to be there, right?
Exactly.
So we got there.
Setting yourself up for failure.
Exactly. We got there. We hiked up the hill about kind of like gray light, just before first light or so. And it's kind of quiet right off the bat there. Panic set in just a little bit. I couldn't really tell. You were wearing my size 11... rubber boots,
right? So blisters immediately.
Yeah, your mind was elsewhere.
Will we sit on this tree or this tree or this tree or this tree?
We'll walk to this tree and then we'll back up because this other tree looks better, but actually the first tree looks like it might have been the better choice, so instead let's compromise and go with like the fourth or fifth tree. That's kind of how this morning went, right?
Yes, the crux of turkey hunting is choosing the tree.
Where'd you hear that? Well, eventually we did hear some gobbles. We got set up, and it's actually like right after we got set up, we finally started hearing gobbles. It was kind of perfect timing, but we had one bird kind of ahead of us. I guess where we were facing was in front of us, kind of on one side of this big draw that we walk up when we go in. And then there's another big draw to the north of that that had what turned out to be quite a few birds in it. And so we decided to go with the closer of the two, which happened to be the ones that flock to the north. Turns out there's an awesome little logging road on this property that I didn't even know about, but they did a clear cut recently. Just really cool, like perfect, like kind of like picturesque, exactly what you picture of like a turkey, a timber bird walking down a logging road. Like this was it. And we got set up. We had a bird that was sounding off for, I mean, the better part of an hour probably, right? And we got set up. Heard him still kind of like, he hung out on this one point for quite a while.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we moved a little bit, started calling a little bit more. All of a sudden we heard some hens, right?
Right.
And then called to them a little bit.
They were going crazy.
Those hens were firing up the gobbler that was still over there. And
what turkey calls were you using?
I was kind of doing a little bit of everything. I had two mouth calls with me, and I had the Weathered Oaks two-sided slate call, which I suck at, by the way. I don't know if you noticed that, but I was...
It was a struggle in the beginning, but you got the hang of it.
Yeah. I'm used to running mouth calls, you know? It is what it is. But in the wind... the glass side of that thing, I think, helped us out, at least for like finding birds, especially when it was really windy right off the bat. You know, once we were just trying to get those shot gobbles and a few responses from birds, that was awesome. But then, yeah, we got set up, switched to the mouth call, and had a couple birds come in silent, right? What can you tell us about those?
Small beards, for starters, a couple of 2-inchers.
Jeez Louise. Not even going to try to make a joke. But, yeah, so we had a couple Jakes come in silent, too, which was weird.
They were quiet.
But, I mean, they were super close, probably like 10 yards or so.
Bright heads.
Yep. Red heads, white heads. But they were, it was kind of funny. They definitely saw us, right? And then they...
I don't know. Yeah, definitely. And then, but they were very casual about it.
Right. But they started putting at us a little bit. Pulled a trick out of Matt Strime's playbook and just tried doing some soft calling at them. And they actually hung out for a lot longer than I was expecting.
Longer than they should have.
Right? I mean, if they had full-length beards, one, they wouldn't have done that. But two, maybe we would have had a bird then. I don't know. Would have been too easy.
Maybe. So then how long do you think it was after they walked away until?
We probably gave them, what, 15, 20 minutes?
Before you started calling again?
I think so. Well, we got up and moved.
And hearing gobbles?
Yeah, we got up and moved because we heard this Tom kind of come to our side of the draw. And he was sounding off like crazy. And so we decided, it sounded like he was kind of going up the hill. And basically we just didn't want him to do exactly what those Jakes had done because it was a weak side shot for me. And so we decided, let's get up above him so it might be easier for us to call him up, right? And then from there, we got in there.
We were switching trees again, looking for a next tree. And as we're moving, you were calling, which you've decided.
Stupid idea. Don't do that again. Yeah, folks listening, this was your second turkey hunt.
Yeah.
Right? We did one, like a late season hunt last spring, and it was pretty uneventful. We just saw like one hen, heard like maybe three gobbles. It just wasn't good. Today we heard a lot of gobbling.
A lot of action going on in the woods this morning. A
lot of action. And so, yeah, I broke the quintessential rule of turkey hunting, and I called before I had a tree picked out. Ripped a couple of yelps, some sharp clucks and whatnot, had birds fire back at us probably within 100 yards just down the hill from us.
So we dropped to the ground, just right where we're standing. We just dropped.
I don't know. In hindsight, do you think we could have gotten to another tree?
I thought exactly where we were was fine. And you guys will hear why. But it was fine where we were. I think that we could have skated by for a couple more yards. And you'll find out why that's important.
Probably. You're going to throw me under the bus here. So we got set up there. I mean, it was probably within, let's see, we called, they gobbled back, we dropped. Called a little bit more, got them fired up. I started cutting them off. They started gobbling back, you know, kind of in unison. Turns out there were two of them.
Yeah, it was hardcore.
Very hardcore turkey hunting. We were, so we sat there, and I mean, they were on us within eyesight, and probably, I mean, it was less than 5 minutes, I think. I mean, they were on a mission to come up and find us. Now, here's where things got a little sideways. So this logging road was probably like a foot and a half, 2 feet lower than the elevation point that we were on. We were up in the timber probably 20 yards, 15, 20 yards off the trail, but we were kind of angling down the trail like a 45 to where we thought maybe there was. I basically just had like an open, what I thought was an open-ish clearing. So these guys start gobbling. I see redheads start coming in. One's popping up, periscoping. The other one's white, little kind of like I can see it, just little glimpses of it here and there. But nothing crazy. And all I could see with the other one who had the redhead was his head would pop up, periscope. I convinced myself he was staring straight at us because I was like, we do not have enough cover.
I didn't get that, but you were definitely worried about that.
Well, their vision is ridiculous.
Right, and I know much less than you do about the birds. But you said, if he pops his head up again, I'm going to take the shot.
Yeah. Which you then tried to talk me out of.
I said, don't rush it.
Yeah, that's...
Because these birds were so far away still, and there was... brush, lots of brush.
Yeah.
And maybe brush, more than brush.
Brush, berm. I think there was a submerged log maybe like in the midst of that leafy stuff. Long story short, I got it in my head that this bird had us pegged because the two of us were huddled up at the bottom of, you know, maybe a 12-inch diameter tree. Like it wasn't ideal by any means, but we saw this bird on the left. His head was popping up, popping down. I could just kind of see it working through. And I was like, why the hell can't I see the back of his fan? Like, he should be strutting. He should be, you know, I was a little surprised that I didn't hear, you know, spitting and drumming or anything like that. Like, neither bird was, they gobbled at us, but neither bird was, like, putting on a show for us at that point. And so I started to panic.
They were still so far away.
We went and arranged it. They were between 40 and 55 yards from where we were at. So we will say that. But basically, I thought this bird was standing in this kind of light, thin-leafed, green, juicy, leafy foliage. And it turns out that they were actually down on the logging road with this foot and a half of dirt shield, basically, like, blocking them from the neck down. And didn't matter anyways. I mean, they had that as an insurance policy, but I just made a bad shot.
Just botched it.
Just ripped one over top of their head. And turns out, you know, so that was, what, like 8 o'clock or so by the time that happened?
Yeah, probably, and pretty close to exactly.
The wheels just fell off, because at that point, I took the shot, I popped up.
Starts raining.
It started raining, like, almost on cue as soon as I took the shot. Starts raining. The bird that was on the right, who I just caught glimpses of, he took off and started flying. I popped up looking for the bird, seeing if he was flopping. The one that I shot at
just takes off running.
He was sprinting, just roadrunner style, just hauling ass out of there. And that was that. It was almost dramatic. It was a terrible dramatic finish to our hunt. All that work we put in, all the blisters, you know, letting a round off, educating some birds, which, you know, that was what we, there were two silver linings to the hunt.
There was
more than that.
To be fair, a good 10 minutes of, God, I can't believe I did this.
Yeah.
So angry. But then once that subsided.
Yeah, there was some profanity.
Yeah.
And, kicking a brush.
We'll keep it clean here. But once that subsided and the anger dissipated, we agreed that we taught two toms a lesson today and two birds got to live.
Yeah, if anything, we're educating the birds on that property so that they might live to see another day.
A couple of pardoners.
Yeah, exactly. We pardoned the turkey today, if anything. And, you know, we were texting a handful of people afterwards, and, you know, the best reminder that I got was, the good news is I get to go hunting again tomorrow. I don't, because we got stuff to do, but we still have a tag. We get to continue going hunting. Hopefully by the time this comes out on Tuesday, it'll be Tuesday the 23rd. Hopefully by then we'll have a bird down. But for those listening, we'll record this in real time here. What's the plan for the upcoming, our next hunt on Friday?
Friday. What is the plan for our next hunt on Friday?
Well, we're going to be up at my folks' place. We're going to go out to, we're going to chase some birds around there. We're going to chase some birds around a neighbor property, which I've had some success on in the past, that we went out to last year. Weren't able to connect on one last year, like we said, but
the plan for Friday, I'd say, is we get a turkey.
Wake up and shoot a bird, yeah.
Heck yeah.
That sounds good to me.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
No. Well, folks, there you have it. That's our story from opening day. Hopefully you enjoyed that. You think your blisters are going to be healed up by Friday?
I'd say so.
Hopefully. Might have to get you your own real pair of boots, so you don't have to trudge around in mine and tear your feet apart. But you know, it was kind of funny to look at, though. But
hobbling.
But yeah, folks, that's our turkey story here. This week, I'm talking with Alec Beckers. I had an awesome conversation with Alec. He's from the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And we kind of did a recap of the spring hearing, which recently happened. As we record this, it was a week ago. By the time this comes out, it'll be almost 2 weeks ago that the spring hearing came around. And for those of you who aren't aware, the spring hearing is really an opportunity for the DNR to propose things for input, from the Conservation Congress to propose potential, you know, motions, initiatives, what have you, and for citizens really, you know, to propose different resolutions that they'd like to see. It's an awesome opportunity for us as conservationists and outdoorsmen to, you know, really provide input and make our voices heard and provide input on what we'd like to see, you know, the future of Wisconsin's game management look like? And so there's a wide range of things. Alec and I came into the conversation kind of with the intent of just chipping off a few questions that were on the questionnaire. There were some really good ones, but really kind of evolved into a question or an episode on how we as hunters and outdoorsmen need to do better when it comes to making our voices heard and taking the initiative to contact your, you know, fisheries biologist, your deer biologist, attend your CDAC meetings, which as this comes out, it's this week, folks. So look that up real quick if you haven't already. But all in all, it was an awesome conversation with Alec. He's always a pleasure to have on. I always learn a ton when I speak with him. And yeah, without further ado, I think we're just going to dive on in. Hopefully by the time you hear this, we'll have a bird on the ground. Hopefully by the time you hear this, you've either already attended your CDAC meeting or have plans to do so. But with that, enjoy the episode, folks. Hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick moment to remind you that this episode is brought to you by XOP. Folks, XOP has been changing the mobile hunting game for years, and they are constantly innovating to provide you with the cutting edge mobile hunting equipment to get you kitted out with lightweight, dependable gear that's going to allow you to get in the best position possible to cross paths with that target buck this fall. But they don't just have sticks and stands. This turkey season, I'm going to be running around the woods in their Meleagris turkey vest, and I am pumped about it. It's got tons of storage, an awesome back pad and seat, and most of all, it's lightweight. Do yourself a favor and go check out xopgear.com for all your mobile hunting needs. Now, let's get on to the episode. All right, folks, this week I'm joined by Mr. Alec Beckers from the Wisconsin chapter of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Alec, how you doing, man?
Good, man. I'm a little jealous that you got to go out turkey hunting this morning and I didn't. I got to wait one more week until it's time for my tag.
Well, yeah, you know, that's all right. Because here's what you didn't do. You didn't whiff on a tom that you spent the better part of an hour and a half going back and forth with, calling all the way across a draw. So you didn't whiff on a bird this morning. And this weekend you get to go to the... So we're recording this April 17th, and that's right before you leave for the National BHA Rendezvous up in Minneapolis, right?
That's correct. Here's the bright side of your whiff this morning, from my perspective at least, is, you know, the classic Michael Scott Wayne Gretzky quote of you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. So I guess we both miss shots today.
This is true.
I just didn't waste any of my, you know, $50, $75 a box TSS this morning. But yeah, I'm headed up to Minneapolis for a rendezvous where we'll be gathering all BHA members across the country are invited to this rendezvous. It'll be my first time going. And I'll be going as a chapter leader, trying to learn a little bit more from other chapters across the country and how we can do a little bit better in Wisconsin and hang out with some like-minded people.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, I talked to Bryce Becker. I talked to Jeff Hintz. I've spoken with Matt Reel and stuff leading up to the North Country Icebreaker that we had back in February over at Koshkonong Mounds. And that was like my first little taste into all that BHA has to offer. And I mean, the camaraderie there was absolutely second to none. So I'm like, man, I'm jealous that you're getting to head up there and meet with, not just folks from the state of Wisconsin, but also folks from, you know, all across the country who share these like-minded goals, who have the passion for the outdoors that, that we all do. And, I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff going on at this one, too. I know, like, some of the meteor crew is going to be up there. There's turkey calling competitions, the whole wild game dinner. I mean, I would almost sacrifice a turkey tag to be able to go with you on this one.
I did sacrifice, or at least deferred a turkey tag for a week to go to this. But for those of us local to Wisconsin, I'll also give a shout out to Ryan Ebert. Ryan Ebert Art. He's going to be at the BHA rendezvous displaying some of his spearing decoys.
Yeah.
Fish spearing stuff that he's into, you know, sturgeon spearing in Wisconsin. And then you have bike and whatnot in Minnesota and Michigan. But Ryan Ebert, great guy to check out as well. Very knowledgeable on dark house beering. And he's also a photographer. And I can personally attest to his skills, because he's going to be photographing my wedding coming up.
So, there you go. Awesome.
Yeah, small world, huh?
Definitely, man. Is he going to be like carving any custom decoys like as a wedding gift for you guys as well? Are you guys going to have little, fish spearing decoys on top of the wedding cake instead of little bride and groom? Did you run that past the fiance or no?
Man, I hope not. And Ryan, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry, because that's just mean I'm going to have to tip him more. These weddings are expensive enough. I got hunting stuff that I want to buy. I can't spend all this money on a wedding and still, want to look cool out in the woods.
Right. Exactly. It's funny you say that. I was talking to my buddy, Gus Merwin, who we had on last week. Well, before I jump to that, folks, we're talking a lot about Ryan Ebert here. He's been on the show before. He's an awesome guy. He does some awesome decoys. Go follow him on social media. Go check him out. I believe it's at Ryan Ebert Art. And if you're going up to the rendezvous, go stop by his booth. Tell him you said hi. Tell him I say hi, since I'll be running around the turkey woods and, buy a decoy. He's got some really cool artwork as well, but go support him, because he's doing awesome, awesome stuff. But my buddy Gus, who I had on last week, I was texting him yesterday saying that I was just, letting him know that I was getting ready to, do the posts and stuff on social media and all that. I sent him the link to the episode so that he'd have access to it and, he could share it however he wanted. And he responded to me and he goes, "I had a weird dream last night that you sent me a message that you were going to bump the episode a week because you found a new guest who was like a tax expert and was going to come onto the show to talk about how to maximize your tax return to buy more hunting and fishing gear," which is about the best dream that I can think of. Like, if there's ever a reason to like bump an episode, I don't know that I would do it to him, but I mean, sounds like he just got his tax return and he's got some ulterior motives floating around in his head that are infiltrating his subconscious.
So funny enough, I do have a good amount of accounting experience, accounting and corporate finance. I'm not, however, a CPA, so I cannot provide you any tax advice. But if you get a hold of me separately, I can give you some of my personal opinions on how to deal with the IRS. Don't take it as legal advice, but I do have a lot of cool hunting gear. So I'll say
the master of the write-off is what that sounds like.
One way or another, I'll find a way to spend money on stuff that I don't need.
Either that or it's Alec Becker's tax evasion 101 course that folks need to enroll in.
This is a complete aside, but we had our Learn to Pheasant hunt this past fall down at my area near Milwaukee, and I had a few new mentors that were helping me out for the first time, and we were all kind of hanging out, talking about stuff, and this one mentor, Megan, phenomenal person, very involved in the outdoors, specifically around mentoring, but she was talking about how she's a federal agent. And someone in the group goes, "What kind of federal agent?" She goes, "IRS." And this guy, Brian, just chimes in, "Oh, our least favorite kind." So, I do actually know one cool IRS agent that is into hunting just as much as we are. So just goes to show, we come from all walks of life and we're all connected via this, this passion that we have in the outdoors, right?
Absolutely, man. I like that. It's good to know that there's at least a couple of good ones out there, right? So that's excellent. But man, we're not here to talk about, tax evasion and buying new gear as much as we'd like to. We are here to talk about Ryan Ebert, though. God bless that man and his fish decoys. Go, folks, go check him out, will you? For crying out loud. But I wanted to try something a little unique here. And part of what got me, so you and I were, let me rewind here. So it's April 17th right now. A couple weeks ago, 1 week ago, actually, on the 10th, the Wisconsin DNR sent out the 2024 spring hearing questionnaire. Basically, they send this out annually to collect public input on a variety of issues. And I'm going to ask you, I'm going to defer to you a little bit here as well, and filling in the gaps here, because I'm not as well versed in it as you are. But the spring hearing is basically an opportunity for citizens of Wisconsin to provide input on various issues that are being proposed. Are the proposals coming all from the DNR, or some of them citizen proposals, or how does how do we fill in the gaps there?
Yeah, so I'm going to kind of oversimplify all of this. Yeah. But we have these spring hearings every year in Wisconsin that are kind of hosted by the Wisconsin Conservation Congress, which is a board of people elected on a county by county basis, mm-hmm. that are normal citizens that are meant to represent conservation within the whole state of Wisconsin, and specifically on behalf of your county. That's kind of the first aspect of these spring hearings that I think is super important to know, is that's the opportunity for you to go and vote and elect your representatives for your county on a 2 and 3 year term basis. There are people that run in counties that do not support hunting and fishing like we do, and they want their voice to be heard on this Wisconsin Conservation Congress. So this spring hearing, the first order of business is actually elections for Wisconsin Conservation Congress. Then the meeting moves into the spring hearing input, the public input opportunity. And there's kind of three aspects that it's broken down into. One is questions from the DNR being posed to the public saying, hey, we've got an idea. We want to know what the public thinks about it before we start, you know, changing any rules or anything like that. So there's these questions from the DNR requesting public input. There's also questions coming from the Conservation Congress saying, hey, what do you guys think? What does the public want to see with X, Y, and Z? And then the third piece is citizen resolutions that are submitted by people in your county. You vote on citizen resolutions that were brought up in your county on whether you see that, you know, whether you support it or not. These are all non-binding advisory questions to the DNR and to the Wisconsin Conservation Congress. So I don't want to, you know, say that if you vote or there's a vote on one aspect that passes and you don't want to see that happen, it's not necessarily going to become law tomorrow, but it is an advisory question for the DNR to shape what direction they're headed with all of these rules and regulations and management practices. So it's a really good opportunity for every person in the state. You know, we have 600,000 people that buy a deer license every year. We don't have anywhere near 600,000 giving their input to the DNR and to the Conservation Congress on what they want to see happen.
Right.
So we've got a lot of room to grow in that area.
Definitely, man. Thank you for breaking that down so nicely there. That was I'm glad you're here. That's why you're here, man. Cause that I would have stumbled over that like crazy. So thank you for breaking that down, kind of setting the scene there. You know, that so many things jumped out at me too from our conversation with Jeff Hintz at that we did back in, I believe it was February, talking about the Conservation Congress. And I remember distinctly he said that when it comes to these hearings, if 10 people show up, to voice their opinion on an issue, or 10 people, or I'm sorry, this was contacting state representatives. That's right. But it, regardless, if 10 people contact their state reps, that's considered a lot by their standards. Like, people, they do not get very much input. So this is an awesome opportunity to help submit your own opinions, help shape, or at least, you know, nudge in the right direction, you know, what you'd like to see conservation look like in the state of Wisconsin here. So with that, you know, we mentioned before, they send out the annual questionnaire. And so it's, I think this year it was 49 questions, with I mean, what a range of topics too. I mean, everything from how we want to classify trout streams, to quartering deer, I think it was. And then, I mean, you mentioned when off air wake boats and stuff like that, or, you know, wakeboarding, and whether or not these boats should be allowed, you know, as live scope, should that be allowed, all the way down to, I mean, what can we all agree on being the state designating as the state butterfly, right? I mean, it was a really, really wide range of questions, and a lot of really good questions too. It was a lot of stuff that I found extremely interesting. Stuff that, you know, you had even reached out to me about last week, you know, kind of asking for my opinion and stuff on some of the trout related stuff. And it just got me thinking, you know, the more I read through it, I'm like, shoot, but these are awesome questions. These are awesome issues or initiatives, whatever you want to call them, that if you're not aware of what the, you know, if you're not aware of the spring hearing or the whole process, I mean, these might just go right over your head. And so I wanted to have you on so we could discuss some of these, pitch a couple back and forth, to kind of give people a flavor of sort of what kinds of questions are on this questionnaire, how the process works, like you just explained, and hopefully encourage people to mark their calendars for next spring so that they will be more willing to participate if they haven't this year, and really just have an idea of what kind of stuff is being debated in the state of Wisconsin. So I figured we would just pull from the questionnaire here. I wanted to start with you. Was there any question or debate here that really jumped out to you?
Man, there was a lot. Mm-hmm. I think the first thing that struck me about the spring hearing is that there were a lot of people that showed up. There were a lot of hunters that wanted to come, hunters and anglers that wanted to come voice their opinions, but there are also a lot of people on the opposite side, mm-hmm. That wanted to make their perspectives heard. That's a very general statement, but if I give the example of wakeboard or wake boats, mm-hmm. There were probably 15 people in the room in my county that were coming to lobby on behalf of wake boats so they can keep these boats in our waters. And there weren't a lot of people that were knowledgeable on the other side saying, right. Well, what does this do to our fisheries? What does it do to the wildlife habitat that we have in our lakes and rivers? So using that as an example, the first thing that struck me is we want educated opinions to show up and make your voice heard. But especially around some of the kind of anti-hunting or more restrictive regulations around hunting and fishing, mm-hmm. There was a number of those. Some of them don't necessarily have that bad of an impact as we kind of think about. And you have to dive in a little bit more to some of these regulations. So like a good one to start would be this trout stream regulation. Mm-hmm. I think that was a hotly debated question, more offline, like after the hearing, than anything. Yeah. I've seen a lot of people in the fishing community saying, you know, this is bullshit. We need to make sure we're protecting our trout fisheries. Mm-hmm. And yeah, everyone can get behind that. You know, I trout fish every now and then. I'm not a serious angler, but I default to well, what is the biological perspective? Mm-hmm. What does the fisheries biologist have to say about this?
Yeah.
And in the case of this one, trout stream regulations, we kind of have the green, yellow, red system of trout stream classifications. Mm-hmm. Today that all have different restrictions on bag limits, size limits, etc. And the proposal was to make a statewide bag limit of 5 and no size restriction, which yeah. right off the bat, it's like, well, why would I want to do that? That sounds like it's going to harm the trout.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually read into it a little bit and hear what the biologists have to say, the way it's structured would actually be the statewide default would be 5 trout bag limit and no size restriction. And it would, so that would kind of be your green streams.
Yeah.
Then yellow would be done away with as a category, but we would maintain the red stream by stream specific regulations. So if you have yellow streams, they would either bump up into that green category, which would mm-hmm. default to 5, no size limit, or they'd go red and you'd be able to manage it on a watershed basis and say, right. well, this stream, we need to protect, our spawning is not that great. We need to protect the local brown trout and brook trout by X, Y, and Z regulations. So I think the intent of that regulation is to still manage our fishery to the best of the biological abilities,
mm-hmm.
but simplify the understanding from somebody who's just picking up a reg book for their first time.
Right.
And that I think makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we can have those debates on should this stream be treated differently? Should it be a green or a red? Fine. But let's have those debates with a biologist.
Right. Absolutely, man. Yeah. It's, my mind jumps to kind of the whole northern forest region proposed doe ban, right?
Yeah.
And how that was kind of just a blanket law that would then apply to that entire region, even in counties where maybe herd numbers were fine, or, obviously there were enough counties up there that they, there was a little bit of warrant for that, for that proposal there. I don't love how that proposal came about, but that's another issue. I think, it is the kind of thing. And I think what we all can kind of aspire to in terms of, how, whether it be deer management or whatever wild game, deer, trout, turkeys, whatever wild game we're trying to, pursue or manage whatever you want to call it, having a dynamic approach to it, that's not a one size fits all kind of approach, where they're all green and no matter what. Cause as soon as you said that, and I mean, I cringed when you said, bag limit 5, no size restriction. I was like, ooh, what about the brood stock, man? And then, it devolved into, or evolved into, the red classifications of, being on a stream by stream, basis there as well. And, and that's the thing. It's, having the fisheries biologist on hand to facilitate these things, like you said, is absolutely critical. Just like having the deer biologist on hand is critical when making decisions pertaining to these, various species and, types of game. And so, yeah, that one jumped out to me a ton. And, you can see both sides of it. And that was one thing that I really appreciated from the DNR was like, they gave you a very unbiased, unloaded, question when they posed all of these proposals and stuff. Now, there's certain things, I had the gut reaction of like, no size restriction. Are you kidding me? That's nuts. That's bullshit. but it comes with a time and a place. Right. And so, I mean, much like all things, the trout one is weird. Cause there was two parts to it, right? Well, there were a handful of trout questions on there. One of them, which I believe was either right before or right after, the one you just mentioned there too, was bumping up the statewide general open season for trout and salmon on inland streams, springs, and spring ponds to the first Saturday in April instead of the first Saturday of May, like it traditionally is. Didn't really make a lot of sense to me. And it sounded like that one was kind of coming from the standpoint of more so from an angler opportunity standpoint than an actual, you know, fisheries welfare standpoint, right? And so that was, I don't know, I didn't love the wording of that one because it was, I mean, they, I think if I remember it, they mentioned, you know, it would make bank access easier for anglers who are trying to target trout. You know, basically it would make bank access easier because the grass isn't so high. It's easier to cast and, you know, whatever it may be or whatever, rather than having to push into, you know, the summer months when all the bank grass is head high and, you know, yeah, some of our smaller class one streams start to get choked over and stuff. But at the same time, like, I mean, I'm still guiding in that. I'm still, you know, I know hundreds of people who are still fly fishing in that, you know, who look forward to that season, even when they can, you know, slap a hopper pattern, you know, just off the bank grass, whatever it may be. So I don't know. I think, again, bring the biologist in, right? Makes me a little nervous, you know, if that would open up the harvest season a month early. But, you know, at the same time in the springtime, I'd oftentimes see fish a little bit more keyed in on bugs than they do, you know, then, you know, I don't know, trout are going to chase spinners and eat worms and whatever. And, you know, maintaining that, you know, the protection in terms of like what kinds of lures, you know, the artificial lure only restrictions and stuff like that, I think are key. But yeah, man, I fully agree with you that, you know, it's an interesting take. And I want to back up just a little. Well, it's an interesting take in terms of, you know, trying to simplify the regulations, which, like, on one hand, I get, but also most streams at the bridge, there's a sign that says daily bag limit 3 or whatever the regulation is for that body of water. And I get the more bodies of water that you regulate on a watershed by watershed basis, the more work that, you know, is for the DNR. I'd be really, really curious to see how many of those streams that are maybe yellow jump to green. And if you were to really draw the map up, how many of those streams would stay, well, would become green in the grand scheme of things, and how many would go red? Because I have a feeling more than most of them would remain green. Or, I'm sorry, not green, red. I think, man, I've been up since freaking 3:30 for turkey hunt today. My brain's foggy, but I would imagine that the majority of them are going to stay red and not green. I'd be really curious to see which ones they would be willing to lift that restriction on. I want to back up to something. Sorry, go ahead.
I think from a process perspective, it's also, again, important to remember that these are advisory questions, that the DNR is genuinely interested in what do you guys think as the public. If they were to change the regulation, especially as impactful as, you know, drought regulations, changing up how we do the whole stream classification, I have to imagine there's going to be more public input opportunity specific right to regulations. And then past that, we should also try to remember that the DNR's first, like, priority is the resource.
Mm-hmm.
And maintaining and managing that resource at sustainable levels, followed up by opportunity.
Right.
It is always a balancing act that they have to do, but they're never going, well, I shouldn't say never. The idea is that they're not going to create opportunity at the expense of the resource.
Right. Definitely. Yeah, that's it. Very, very well put there, because that's, you're right. You can't manage trout if you don't have any trout to manage at the end of the day, right? So that's, yeah, that's spot on, man. On the fish note there too, how about the whole proposed panfish limit reduction? And not, again, I say proposed, that's the wrong word, but it was on the questionnaire, not necessarily being, you know, up for proposal, but I know I've heard it discussed prior to the spring hearing, you know, kind of kicking around this, you know, drop reduction of the daily panfish limit to 10 panfish. In this case, they're suggesting only 5 can be crappie. Man, that's a big change from, you know, I remember in high school and stuff, guys going out with, you know, their buddies for the weekend and coming back with, you know, 75 bluegills and crappies or perch or whatever it may be. I mean, that I can see a lot of people being up in arms after, you know, taking 25 a day for, you know, how many weekends in a row of their lives and stuff and, you know, what have you. And I mean, at the end of the day, depending on where you're at, 25 fish is a lot, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think about it in two ways. One is like my personal ethics of how I operate in fishing scenarios. Mm-hmm. Like, love ice fishing. Man, I cannot imagine a scenario where I'm going home with more than 5 crappies. Right. I would, like, I don't want to fillet that many fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't need 75 bluegills.
Right.
So I'm not going to do that, but that's not everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what kind of equipment I'm using. My personal limit for fish is going to be the same, whether I'm ice fishing, using a bamboo, you know, tenkara rod with a chunk of hot dog hanging off of a circle hook. Doesn't matter. I'm still going to take home the same amount of fish. But I think the bag limit from a regulatory perspective, and this is my perspective, I'm not trying to speak on behalf of the DNR, but is a means to kind of wrangle some of all of these different electronics,
mm-hmm.
different fishing equipments that, you know, we've had so much innovation in the last, you know, 25, 50 years,
right,
in the outdoor industry. You've got so much more technology at your disposal now, on top of it being very hard to manage and enforce your possession limits.
Mm-hmm.
You're only allowed to have 3 times your daily bag limit.
Right.
If those people that are bringing home buckets of bluegills, are they really only keeping 3 days worth? That, mm-hmm. I think, is the question. So where I would see the DNR's reasoning behind this being, well, if we reduce bag limit, we can kind of curtail some of those outsized impacts of, you know, forward-facing sonar, 360-degree yep. view of things,
right,
as well as the people that are not maybe as in tune with the possession limits as you or I would be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of standardizing and peanut butter spreading that across the board. And it may be a little bit of pain for us in the short term.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, what you said there is key, pain in the short term, right? Yeah. It's cool when we've got, you know, I just dropped, I don't know how much they cost. I dropped, you know, a few $100 on, you know, live scope stuff or whatever. Now you're going to tell me I can't have it. Like, what the hell? Like, so I have to go to take it to another state that does allow it or anything. It's the kind of thing, and the live scope thing and the technology as a whole. And I'm going to try not to dive down a rabbit hole here, but I'd like to hear your perspective on this. If they were to ban live scope, or the, you know, the forward facing sonar and that kind of stuff, do you think that opens the door for tighter restrictions, eventually potentially banning of cell cameras? Because the two of them are kind of, you know, the equivalent, you know, the fishing equivalent and the hunting equivalent of one another, right? They're both trying to deliver things in real time or close to it. A lot of technology is getting into the outdoor space right now, man. And it's cool to see, because boy, if there were no restrictions on this, we would be out of fish and out of deer really freaking quick. But I'm curious on your take. Do you think that opens the door?
Directly, no. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to face discussions around cell cameras one way or the other.
Sure.
Separately. I do see them as kind of separate issues in the sense that I guess you could sit 50 yards away from your cell camera and get that text on your phone and say, mm-hmm. Buck headed my way. Right. It's not as real time as me having a live scope and saying, oh, I should move my bait 6 inches to the left.
Yeah.
On the live scope piece, the two things that because I do not have any live scope equipment, not something that it's pretty far down my list of hunting and fishing stuff that I want to buy. It's on
of
there.
All the gear you use your tax evasion money on, you don't buy live scope, Alec. Come on.
I love Garmin, but I look at it from a funding standpoint. So that's all fishing equipment. So mm-hmm. it is all subject to Dingle Johnson excise tax. So we are receiving the benefit of these high value electronics kicking money back into our fisheries funding. So that's good. I don't necessarily want to see Live Scope's price get cut in half because that would mean our funding gets cut in half. But the other aspect is talking to the fisheries biologist, and not to parrot him or quote him directly, but he said there's not a population level impact that live scope, forward facing sonar, whatever you want to call it. It's not a specific population level impact that it's having. And that's where I think it comes back to the bag limits and different methodologies and equipment of fishing, that you can have someone sitting there all day with a stick, fishing line, and a piece of hot dog on the end of it and pulling in 75 bluegill.
Yeah.
And it'll take them all day. Then you have a guy with a live scope. Maybe it'll only take him a couple hours to get that same 75 fish, but it's still the same impact. Like that same number of fish are still coming out of the lake or the river.
Right.
It's just a matter of time. So that bag limit evens the playing field for both of those fishermen in that scenario. So
true.
Holistically, the DNR is trying to manage all of it. I don't personally have an opinion or a position on live scope other than biologists told me it's doesn't have a population level impact. So I voted no opinion on that.
Right. Absolutely, man. That's such an excellent point on the bag limit having more impact than the means of take, right? And I'd be curious to see, my mind keeps wanting to like translate this back to hunting too, trying to find the parallels. And
I've got a great, a great segue into that I was talking to the fisheries biologist about. It's like, well, the public perception at the very least is that live scope makes you more effective in your method of take, right? Archery equipment. A crossbow is perceived as more effective method of take.
Mm-hmm.
In Wisconsin, I'll just say in Wisconsin, I do not believe there is data to show that there has been a population level impact from either live scope or crossbow usage comparative to other means of take.
Sure.
So does that technology make you more effective hunter, maybe, or fisher? Maybe it makes you more effective. Is that having a negative impact on the resource? Not that we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the crossbow side, I don't remember what it is. It's like $10 more to upgrade your archery license to a crossbow.
Yep.
Maybe we should think about the same thing for fishing electronics. That if you're already spending $8,000 on a piece of electronics, if you want to use that, maybe kick in another $10-15 on a stamp. We have it on the hunting side with crossbows. So how do we address that public perception, whether it's LiveScope or crossbow usage, well, we can turn that into a funding mechanism for the sustainment of the resource in the state, like we have with our archery crossbow license.
Totally. Dude, so many good points right there. One of them that jumped out to me was efficiency. And you've got, you know, if you have the LiveScope, you're going to be a lot more efficient than you are if you're, you know, catching bluegills with the cane pole and hot dogs, right? And so, you know, my mind just kind of naturally drifts towards trout again. If you're in a boat, you've got LiveScope, you're not necessarily having, you know, theoretically, so long as you're not, you know, leaking fuel or whatever it may be into the body of water, or, you know, running over, you know, structure with your, you know, with your tail or anything like that. You know, when you put it in terms of, you know, it's the same, you know, impact on the population. One's just doing it in 2 hours and the other one's doing it in, you know, 10. I start to think here about trout in terms of like, okay, well, you know, if I were to fish with, if I were, say I'm fishing for keep, and this is a big if or whatever, but, you know, from an efficiency standpoint, if I can focus on one hole and I can pluck, I don't know how many fish out of that hole, and I only, you know, wade in or near that hole rather than wading through an entire, you know, walking on the bank, you know, you should be on the bank more than you're wading in the water, but still it has its impact because then you're contributing to your own, you know, source of erosion. I don't think anyone would deny that the stream bed would be better off if we didn't walk through the middle of it. Not that, you know, deer and other animals don't do the same thing, but, you know, it raises the question of when we look into this efficiency, if I'm not impacting the fishery by harassing these fish for, you know, however many hours in a day, just like I'm not maybe putting a, you know, a slightly iffier shot on an animal with my vertical bow versus my crossbow, is there an ethical piece to that? And I don't know that there's an answer to it, but I mean, from an animal welfare standpoint or a game welfare standpoint, maybe even habitat welfare standpoint, where do you, where and how do you draw that line? Right. Because you've got, you know, and again, I'm, you know, I don't have a stance either way towards how people want to pursue their game. It's your tag. You fill it how you want to, but from the standpoint of, well, you know, anybody can grab the crossbow and, you know, I haven't scouted. I haven't, you know, maybe not. That's a poor example. I was transitioning to LiveScope. Anybody can, you know, grab the crossbow. I'm sure you still need to practice. Never shot one. So I'm speaking from an, you know, uninformed standpoint here, but I'm speculating. The underlying theme seems to be that you can grab the crossbow. You can, I mean, head out into the woods. You've got that thing dialed in. You're good to go. Whereas a lot of the vertical bow guys or the trad bow guys are practicing damn near year round so that their, you know, their form's good. They're sending how many arrows downrange so that they can prepare for that. Just like, you know, okay, if I'm going to fish this lake and I have to go out there, I got to find fish. It's a hell of a lot easier if I've got a live scope, right? And I'm going to get on the, if in theory, get on those fish or at least find those fish quicker with a little bit less scouting and time input. So I don't know, man. It's I don't know what it is as outdoorsmen. We seem to have this like need for like the purist kind of thing. Like, I think we all kind of have a little bit of a tinfoil hat and, you don't want to be like, well, then I don't know. Like, where do you draw the line if you allow that? Right. Or the, you know, here's this technology. How do we stop, you know, getting too far in? Is it even hunting? Is it even fishing then or anything there? At a certain point, you know, you do have to start to wonder, where do you draw the line? Because you can totally see both sides between the efficiency and the impact on a fishery versus the, well, that's not fishing, that's not hunting, they're using all this technology, they're not just going out and figuring it out or they're not putting the time in. Well, not everyone has the time to put it in, right? And so I don't know. I don't know if I have an end to that thought aside from just both sides of it being there.
So I think it's a good thing that we have all of these very nuanced things to talk about and debate about while keeping the resource in mind. I think about it like when I talk to my parents and they're upset about some very minor inconvenience, I'm like, well, it's a good sign that this minor inconvenience is the worst thing that you have to deal with today.
Yeah.
That's how I think about all of this in hunting and fishing. Like, let's debate efficacy and means of take and all of these things while we still can.
Right.
And as long as we're still having these debates, it means that we're not getting distracted by more threatening issues, which, you know, without being an alarmist, I do think we have a lot of risk in hunting and fishing. That's kind of sweeping across the country, and Wisconsin is starting to see it as well. Specifically in these spring hearings, there were a number of anti-hunting, however you want to look at it, resolutions that were being submitted by our neighbors within our counties that want to see your ability to go out and hunt and fish as you have been. They want to see that restricted. A few that come to mind in terms of this year's Conservation Congress hearings is, you know, number one, they want to shorten, there were resolutions to shorten coyote hunting season from today year round to only August through April or something like that. But take away the year round coyote hunting and it's purely based on social pressures. There's no biological reason to change our coyote hunting structure as stated by biologists within the DNR. And we've seen this, it just happened in Michigan. Our neighbors in Michigan, they just lost year-round coyote hunting. It is being litigated right now, but their DNR or equivalent, I can't remember what their organization is called, but specifically said they're changing the management practice because of social pressures. And that's just coyote hunting. There's also proposals to do away with payments to hound hunters who lost a dog or dogs while pursuing bears because the dogs were killed by wolves. They're singling out these hound hunters saying, you should not get paid by the state for losing your dog. Any kind of, it's not just hound hunters as well. It's upland dogs. It's any kind of hunting dog, retriever, blue tick, whatever.
Really?
They specifically don't want dog owners to be paid, hunting dog owners to be paid out by the state if their dog gets killed by a wolf. They're totally fine with cattle, sheep, horses, whatever. All of the other payments that the state makes to farmers and people in wolf country, totally fine with that. They specifically want hunting dogs to be taken out of that program. So why? Pure social pressure. So we're already starting to see this in Wisconsin, that population dynamics be damned. We don't want to see coyote hunting anymore. Doesn't matter what the biologists say. Doesn't matter that we have year-round coyote hunting and the population has only been growing. They don't want us to be able to do that because they don't like it. And I've always looked at it as, you know, you give an inch, they take a mile. And I know that that kind of buys into the slippery slope fallacy. But we have demonstrated that slippery slope. Look at Colorado, look at Washington, California, all of these things are being done to the detriment of hunters with zero benefit to the resource.
Right.
It's not a lose-lose situation. It's a we-lose situation, which is why I think these public input opportunities are so important. And I'll also add, if you go to these meetings, you raise your hand and speak up, they have to record what you say in the minutes of the meeting by law. And those are on public record. So whenever Waukesha County's is released, you'll be able to see all the dumb shit that I said in my meeting. But this is our opportunity to make our voices heard, defend what we have. And I also think we need to start going on the offensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could probably come up with 5-6 things right now that we'd like to see changed in the reg books, in the laws, whatever, to benefit hunters and anglers. But we're not the ones submitting resolutions. We're not the ones showing up to these meetings and being vocal and mobilizing to get people to support us in passing these things. So we can't risk losing what we have. And I would further that saying, we should start to fight for what we want. Not, you know, guard the gate, right? Play Nukem and the whole meat eater thing. Mm-hmm. He wants to guard the gate. Man, I want to go on the offensive.
Definitely, man. I had no idea about the whole dog thing. It's one thing if it's not one thing. It's not one thing at all. The dog thing as a whole is frustrating. I had no idea that that was all encompassing, from predator hunters all the way up to guys chasing, you know, pheasants, grouse, upland, you know, ducks, whatever the hell it may be, like that.
Well, their reasoning behind it is, you put your dog at risk mm-hmm. by bringing them into like wolf caution zones or something. I can't remember what the language was, but
okay.
You brought your dog out hunting in an area where there's known to be wolf predation. To which the logical response for anybody that's looked at wolf maps is, oh, so about half the state.
Right.
And why am I at risk? Like, am I not allowed to take my dog out anywhere that there's wolves?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to stop there.
Right.
Because wolf population's expanding too, right? Yeah. So that line's going to start moving, and we're going to start losing opportunity if we don't take a firm stance now.
Right. Well, and especially when you look at it from the wolf standpoint, when you've got wolves, which are federally managed, not state managed. So we as Wisconsinites would have zero impact on any sort of wolf control or of any form, really, aside from, you know, what the DNR is doing to, you know, maintain their numbers and tracking on, you know, this is what we would like our wolf population to be around, but there's nothing we can actually do to, you know, try and achieve that goal until they're removed from the endangered species list. And so as a result, you know, is that something that you've seen, you know, through your experience with BHA and stuff? Is that something that you think some of these anti-hunting groups tend to use as leverage, as stuff that is federally managed rather than stuff that's on a state level?
Yeah. And there's a lot of intertwining there. I think wolves is a great example of that. The governor just vetoed a bill where the DNR would be required to create a sustainable population level estimate for wolves in Wisconsin. The reading that we have on this is, you know, myself and my colleagues within BHA, is it's not saying, DNR, you need to give me a number for how many wolves you're going to keep in the state. It's rather, DNR, what is the habitat on the landscape able to support? Give me that number. We have what acreage of sustainable wolf habitat, suitable wolf habitat, and how many wolves per acre can we sustain on that landscape? And that then gives us a biological basis to then draw management objectives off of.
Absolutely.
So the DNR, from our reading, the DNR would still have in this bill authority to manage based on objectives, increase, decrease, maintain, kind of like what we have with deer management.
Yeah.
But the governor vetoed it because wolves are always political. Because the perception then would be we have to manage and, you know, kill off a certain number of wolves to hit that number. That's kind of the governor's perception of it. But having that sustainable number of wolves would benefit our management of this resource when we do have state management of it, because we'd be able to say, here is the biological fact basis behind this. This is what our landscape can do. This means we can harvest X number based on state management. And by the way, especially with wolf hunt, the state of Wisconsin would take a direction of issuing tags theory, not going off of whatever the 2021 hunt. Mm-hmm. That's a totally different,
different
stuff. But them saying, hey, we want to harvest 200 wolves this year. That objective is to maintain the level of population. They're setting these harvest objectives based on what animals can we remove from the landscape today or this year, and the overall population would not be harmed.
Right.
But the governor saying, no, I don't want a number out there. Now we can't manage towards anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole framework that the DNR has for wolf management, it's very abstract and open to interpretation.
Like you said, it's political.
It's political. So
it's a hot topic. There's
less, like, it's less likely that we're going to get state management back,
mm-hmm.
because we don't have a rigid, strong framework to say, this is what we're going to do.
Right. Man, that is so frustrating. I mean, the political side of the outdoor industry is not even the outdoor industry, that just conservation in general. I mean, it's, you know, the hot button issues and stuff. I mean, we already saw it just off the bat with the Northern Forest Region proposed deer ban. It's just like, where the hell did that come from? And it goes all the way back to Ernebuck, you know what I mean? And I'm sure before then as well. The use of, you know, politicians to kind of leverage different conservation practices or ban or, you know, enforce whatever it may be. In the long run, I think it's going to harm the ecosystem of, you know, the state of Wisconsin. But at the same time, we're losing out on a hell of a lot of money. If we were to figure out how to, you know, if we do open up a wolf season again, okay, well, there's money for those tags that's going back into, you know, conservation and, you know, I hesitate to say wolf habitat, but, you know, whatever it may be, it's, you know, funds that are being allocated towards the betterment of wolves and the population that is in place there, you know, in theory. And I think it kind of goes back to the principle of hunters versus anti-hunters, right? And the whole, you know, crux of that debate being whether or not it's okay to kill an animal rather than whether or not it's, you know, if we're to hunt deer, if we're to hunt wolves, whatever it may be, we're actually going to bring in a lot of revenue to then further benefit the environment, to put towards other conservation practices, to put towards, you know, just the betterment of conservation and the environment of the state as a whole. It's frustrating. It's really, really frustrating.
I agree, man. I mean, wolves are federally managed in the Great Lakes region, but we do have state management in the West. The stance of BHA as an organization is we support the scientific management and state-based management of mm-hmm. wolves and grizzly bears, which this is actually a point that a lot of people don't know about BHA and, you know, kind of label us as green decoys.
Mm-hmm.
Say like, oh, well, you know, they're not actually supporting hunters and hunters' rights and all of that stuff. You can go look it up. You can Google it, find the statements. We officially do support state management of wolves, hunting of wolves, and of grizzly bears.
Right.
But I personally, I may be, sometimes it feels like I'm the only person in the state that wants to see wolves across more of the landscape in the state, but also be able to hunt them.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly for your reasoning there of, I'd love to buy, I will buy a $200 wolf stamp.
Right.
You know, like I'd love to, if I have the opportunity to go chase a wolf, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
In Wisconsin specifically. And I'd love to have wolves everywhere in the state, not just packed into the northern third.
Right.
But we'll see what happens. I mean, I don't think that the North American model of conservation has predator hunting and the North American model of conservation at odds with each other.
They, mm-hmm.
they are one and the same. We can hunt predators and have more of them on the landscape. Look at Montana. They allowed hunting. Their wolf population increased. They got more revenue from wolf hunting. And the negative conflicts with humans went down.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's... I mean, I assimilate the two, or, you know, the wolves to... Not obviously they're different, but, you know, I think of it as like coyote hunters. The number of people, if you want to knock on their door and say like, hey, do you care if I coyote hunt in your farm? The number of farmers who are like, hell yeah, go do it. Please clear them out. Like, do whatever you can. Like, get some of these guys off the landscape. Like, and you know, it's obviously within reason, right? There's balance to the two. But yeah, man, like I can sit here and think like, you know, I like that idea of, you know, if you were to, you know, throw a $200 wolf tag out there. So it's not everyone's going to buy it, but the people who do want to buy it, definitely, you know, you still cap it. People who do want to buy it can still, you know, they can still do so. Maybe make it like the duck stamp sort of thing where, you know, you get, you know, the cool artwork or something like that. It all goes towards conservation, whatever it may be. Like there's a, they never got back to me, but a woman from, it was actually an anti-hunting. I think they're anti-hunting. I'd have to go back and read the email, but they were from Wisconsin Wolves and Wildlife, which is like a conservation organization for the, you know, they're pro wolf. Right. And, never heard anything back from them, but you know, it, when you show the numbers versus the loaded, you know, proposal of like, well, we would like to hunt wolves in the state. Okay, well, that's going to raise red flags on the anti-hunter side. Okay, we would like more wolves on the landscape, but be able to hunt them. I don't want more wolves on the landscape, says, you know, the farmers or whoever it may be, right? Do you think there's any, I mean, if, this is, I don't know that we're going to solve this one here, you know, on a national scale. Maybe if, I don't know, maybe we can, who knows? But like, from a standpoint of some sort of resolution, sounds like Montana's a good, I'm not trying to turn this this podcast into a wolf episode here, but it sounds like Montana's a good framework for this you know, for this wolf management practice. Do you think it ever reaches a standpoint or reaches the point of, you know, being more widely accepted, or do you think it's at this point become such a hot issue that different groups are going to leverage it for their own gain throughout?
I think we need to do some education mm-hmm. of the general public
yeah.
from the hunter and conservationist standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I think this like hunting is conservation or hunting is a part of conservation trope is a good place to start, but we need to show people truly what the North American model of wildlife conservation means. And this is kind of exactly how I responded to a woman in my county who was proposing a resolution saying we should create a state-funded grant program for farmers to receive non-lethal deterrents from the state of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So there's less wolf depredation on their livestock.
Right.
I said, that's a great idea. And I think we can fund that grant program by having state management of wolves and selling wolf hunting licenses and or stamps. I think that would be a great opportunity. You know, let's, totally. You know, assuming we have state management, let's open a hunting season, generate money through stamps and license sales to then put back into non-lethal deterrence as well.
Yeah.
Then we have a more dispersed population, you know, more geographically dispersed, I should say. And we're kind of hitting that middle ground of, well, we have a hunting season and we're also pursuing non-lethal deterrence because not every wolf needs to get killed. Yeah. Right.
Right.
And have a mechanism by which hunters can fund this. And the great example here is the Meat Eater podcast talks about this all the time, that after California banned mountain lion hunting, the state killed more mountain lions every year yep. than hunters ever did. And that will happen with any resource that we don't have state management of and the ability to hunt.
Right.
Sandhill cranes is another one, right? The state issues depredation tags for sandhill cranes, but we can't hunt them. Let's open a hunting season. Let's sell a stamp. And yeah, Crane Foundation, you're worried that we're going to shoot a whooping crane. We'll give all of this money from sandhill crane stamps to whooping crane conservation.
Yeah.
Right?
Like education, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
We have this ability to have the best of both worlds under our management system. We just need to go out there and take it. We need to be on the offensive and go set these things up and get these balls rolling instead of having to constantly defend. No, I don't want you to take, you know, 4 or 5 months out of my coyote hunting season.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, man. Yeah. The thing that jumped out to me there was, and it was even one of the questions on the questionnaire this year was, you know, just education and making the information available to people. I think the question on there was, it's like, do you approve of, or are you in favor of increasing education to new, or to like people taking hunter safety? Do you approve of or support education or educational material on the harmful effects of lead or toxic shot, or, you know, toxic lead shot? Yeah, duh. Why wouldn't we? Like, if anything, it's going to teach you, okay, like, I can shoot with this, or I can shoot with, you know, TSS, or, you know, bismuth, whatever the hell you want to shoot with. Like, yeah, why wouldn't you? It's going to make that person more informed, whether they're shooting lead shot or not, whether they have any interest in you know, whatever ammo they buy, they're going to leave that hunter safety hunter education course more informed about yet another sort of thing. You know what I mean? And so I think what you said there about education of the North American model of conservation, education about, well, here's the benefits of what would happen if we did open up a wolf, you know, hunt, and also use that money to put it towards non-lethal trapping and stuff like that. Because the other thing on top of that is somebody's got to go pick up all those filled traps at the, you know, whenever they get filled, and then relocate those wolves wherever they're going to go. There's job creation there as well. You know what I mean? Like, it's, there's a lot of opportunity through, you know, I think that the bad rap that people get is with the North American model of conservation is, you know, well, if we can hunt this thing, then more money will go to it. And so I think that often gets misconstrued as, oh, so you're exploiting that resource. You're exploiting the wolves so that you guys can bring in more money, or you can, you know, do whatever. Well, it's no. We're proposing a controlled, science-backed opportunity to hunt where even the people who don't draw that tag, they still like that money still goes towards conservation. That still money, or money still goes towards good cause, or good cause goes towards those non-lethal traps, whatever it may be. How do you recommend hunters bridge that education gap and work to fill in the gaps for non-hunters? And I guess what, as hunters and conservationists, hunters, anglers, conservation, whatever you want to call it, what as conservationists can we do to go on the offensive, like you said, and to push things forward and to, you know, not just guard the gate, but actually go out and propose things?
I think a great way to get on the offensive in the state of Wisconsin is to show up at our conservation Congress meetings, submit your resolutions that you want to see happen, vote on the ones out there, go to your CDAC meetings, your mm-hmm. Civilian Deer Advisory Council meetings, which start Monday, April 22nd. Every county has one. Go participate in these things and make your voice heard as an outdoors person and give your input on what you want to see happen. I think as far as public education goes, I'm not saying we should go sit out front of our Whole Foods and do a how to gut a deer demo.
Yeah.
Right. Not saying that. But what I am saying is when you come across people that are saying, how could you ever shoot this cute and fluffy animal?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even going to say what animal, just this cute, fluffy animal. Well, do you like this animal? Yeah, of course I do. Do you want to see more of this animal on the landscape and more healthy population? Yeah, absolutely. And wouldn't it be great if we had a way to achieve that by people paying the state to do it?
Right.
You know, people will pay the state for this animal, and hey, they may also get to feed their families while doing it. Yeah, you know, that sounds like a great idea. You know, we can mm-hmm. have people pay the state to do it. They can feed their families. The state has less expense on managing this resource themselves. That sounds like a great idea. Like, congratulations. Welcome to hunting and conservation. You know?
Absolutely. And
we also have to stop this, like, kind of shoot, shovel, shut up mentality. Mm-hmm. Respecting our resources is the common ground that we're going to have with anti-hunters. And I've always felt that my, like, animal ethics are most closely aligned with vegans. I care about animal welfare. They mm-hmm. care about it too. We just choose a different path to reach the same result of animal welfare, and respecting each other's commonly held beliefs of animal welfare, I think, is the starting point to any of these productive conversations. But saying we need to shoot every wolf on the landscape, probably not a great idea. Let's just have open, honest, and pleasant conversations.
Yeah, 100%, man. You hit it right on the head there. And, you know, there, as you were saying that about, you know, okay, do you want to put more, like, would you appreciate more funds going towards conservation protection of this resource or whatever? Okay, well, let's take a look at how much money comes in through the sale of license tags, or, you know, licenses, tags, permits, whatever it may be. Let's take a look at what that brings in compared to, okay, well, how much did your organization throw together? You know, well, you guys are, not to generalize or anything like that, but, you know, well, while you guys are fighting for the protection of this animal, okay, we are too, just in a different manner, but, like, which one's going to be more effective in the long run, right? And so, you know, being aware of that and being able to convey that. And, you know, one thing I think that I would add to that, and this is kind of draws back on a conversation that I had with a friend of mine, Robert Rosenberger, who was on the show back in September. You know, it comes down to, like you said, having pleasant conversations with those people and showing up in ways that you can, you know, you could, the two of you, you know, whether if you're a hunter working with a non-hunting group, find ways to lean in together towards a common goal, whether, you know, the last, I forget how Robert said it, but I think it was like 90% of what we're doing here, we're aligned on. It's the last 10% that we're, you know, one of us wants to, you know, bring a case of shells with us and the other one doesn't, you know what I mean? It's, we're working towards the same goal. And, you know, how many of the people who are, I mean, how many outdoorsmen do you know who are showing up for conservation, who are showing up for, you know, habitat work days versus, you know, maybe non-hunting groups who, not that they're not out doing awesome work and stuff. I mean, one that comes to mind is the Prairie Enthusiasts right now off the top of my head. Cause I mean, those guys are out there killing it, but they also let people come out and hunt because they know, yeah, you can come out here. The hunting's decent. Kind of sucks hunting white-tailed deer and a bunch of prairie grass. I will say that, but those people are willing to, you know, meet in the middle here. Like how do we find more opportunities for us to break bread over those common goals and continue working towards that common objective and that shared objective? Man, every time I talk to you, I learn something. and you know, I always gain a better perspective. I mean, I will say it outright. I mean, you are far more informed on a lot of this stuff than I am. And, you know, I tend to, you know, find myself more so in a state of, you know, opinion kind of stuff really than, you know, being as informed as I would have liked to be. But dude, we're coming up on an hour here. I want to be respectful of your time here. You mentioned the CDAC meetings coming up here. How can folks find the information for that? This is going to come out on Tuesday, so it'll be the day after the first day of CDAC meetings. But if folks want to go and find that stuff, where can they go to find it?
So you can Google Wisconsin CDAC, C-D-A-C, mm-hmm. and it'll take you there, and you can follow the links for your spring hearings. We'll also be pushing out some reminders on social media. Backcountry Hunters, Wisconsin, I think it's at Backcountry Hunters WI is our Instagram handle. We'll be pushing stuff out, but there is a county-specific meeting for every county. They're all on different days, different times, different locations. So you have to find your county or the county that you want to go to that meeting. It's just that will all be posted online. It's already up there. I know mine is on Monday, April 22nd. Mm-hmm. Go in person. And you also get to meet your local deer biologist, forestry representative, all of these cool people that I don't know if you guys know this, but the biologists are usually good people to find some new hunting spots from. I've definitely benefited from that. So on top of this being an opportunity for you to give input, you can also, you know, rub elbows with the DNR and hopefully some other fellow, you know, like-minded hunters and anglers.
Definitely, man. Worst comes to worst, you're going to walk away having learned something, or at least have a direction of what people think in your county about how deer ought to be managed. And, you know, for folks in that northern forest region, you know, here's your opportunity to go and make that, you know, make your opinions heard. Folks in the southern, you know, part of the state where we are, where we have, you know, a pile of deer and, you know, CWD numbers are also high as well. Go to these meetings, talk to your deer biologist, you know, recommend, you know, just share your input, really. Dude, this has been an absolute pleasure. I appreciate you coming on. Folks, mark your calendars. Hopefully by the time this comes out, your CDAC meeting hasn't gone by. Hopefully you've, when you're listening to this, you can sit here and chuckle to yourself that you already attended yours last night. But if you haven't already, folks, join Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. You'll be really freaking glad you did. It's an awesome organization filled with awesome people doing absolutely awesome work. Alec, what's the join link? Isn't it like backcountryhunters.org/join?
Yeah, there's usually some, let me see, because there's usually when we have little, promotions going on, there's a link. I just say go to backcountryhunters.org.
Yeah, the join button's big.
You'll hit a join button right there. We'd appreciate it. The more help, the more members we have, the more help we can be to the state of Wisconsin, whether it's work days out at Goose Lake down here in Southeast, or yelling at people in Madison to pass the bills that we want to see passed. Every member that we have helps further our cause in Wisconsin. And that's all we're trying to do here. Just a bunch of volunteers trying to make sure that our legacy of hunting and fishing is perpetuated for future generations.
Absolutely. Folks, you heard it right there. Go join BHA, go attend your CDAC meeting. And, the questionnaire is still up. If you just search, Wisconsin DNR spring hearing questionnaire, if you're curious about some of the other questions, we only touched on a couple of them today, but if you're curious about those, go check those out and keep an eye out for that email when it comes out next April. It's always in April. Keep an eye out for that email so that next year, if you'd missed it this year, you can provide some input on all the issues that are going to be proposed then or discussed, and it'll also give you the opportunity to attend your hearing. So with that, Alec, man, have a safe trip up to Minneapolis. Good luck in the turkey woods, and thank you so much for coming on, dude. It was a pleasure. That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcast. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram at the Wisconsin Sportsman Pod. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions that you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, Tacticam, Huntworth, and Onyx. Please go support the brands that support this show. And if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.